Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The United States has spent a lot of blood and a lot of treasure over 9 years in Afghanistan. Now it looks like a maddening hunk of that treasure has gone to buying bullets for the Taliban and fattening offshore accounts of fat cat Afghans, including tip-top leaders. It's bad enough as a simple outrage, but now it may be threatening the war effort and its goals themselves. Bottom line, the U.S. may have paid through the nose to guarantee its own failure. This hour on Point, Corruptistan and the future of the U.S. war effort. You can join the conversation. Have you seen it firsthand? The corruption in Afghanistan. Afghan corruption, American corruption. What is it costing? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Kabul in Afghanistan is Matthew Rosenberg, a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, who's done a lot of reporting in recent months on the corruption problem. Matthew, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us from Washington is Greg Miller, national security correspondent for The Washington Post, which has done big work on Afghan corruption as well. Greg Miller, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Matthew, first to you on a little bit of context. Remind us where we stand vis-a-vis these upcoming Afghan elections, and remind us just in brief of the latest U.S. military push in Afghanistan.
The elections are taking place Saturday. It's a parliamentary vote. And I think going into it, a lot of people had thought, you know, President Karzai was going to try and stock the parliament with his allies. There might be a lot of fraud. I think people are still worried about fraud. But increasingly, a lot of the experts here, both Afghan and the foreign observers, seem to think most of the parliament's going to get returned and you're going to end up with the same sort of characters that were there before. That's, you know, been a good and bad thing the last few months. They have at times pushed back against President Karzai. Some of his more unsavory cabinet picks were rejected, but they haven't exactly formed a kind of vigorous legislative branch to the powerful executive branch that the President Karzai leads in Afghanistan. And the other problem is security. Throughout the country, there are a lot of polling stations that are going to be closed. There are going to be less polling stations than there were in the presidential vote because of security concerns. And then down south, in and around Kandahar, where this very large American push is finally kind of gearing into a very military phase. In some of the districts around there probably won't be any voting. There's just too much fighting right now. Inside Kandahar City, there should be some voting. In some of the more peaceful or pacified districts, there will be. In parts of Helmand, where we saw the big fight for Marjorie earlier this year, there are at least four districts that are going to have no voting. So it's a real mixed bag. And I think, you know, one of the things you've seen is, unlike last year where Ambassador Holbrooke, General McChrystal, others were really talking up the elections, the presidential elections last year, as a kind of major step forward for Afghanistan. You've seen very little hyping of this election by Afghan or American officials or European officials.
And Greg, if I may, sorry, Matthew, but Greg Miller in Washington, this American push, we've all seen in this country now the maps of this sort of spreading Taliban influence, no-go zones and heavy influence areas around Afghanistan. What's the goal of this latest U.S. military push around Kandahar, Greg?
The goal, as I understand it, is to bring some security to what had been the Taliban's birthplace. So it's a demonstration in the Taliban's sort of most important sort of home region that security can come and that institutions, basic government institutions, can be provided.
I want to talk about corruption. It's just had more and more and more attention from both your newspapers and from the White House. Here was President Obama at his press conference on Friday. You hear him talking about President Karzai, and then he comes to it.
Every time I talk to President Karzai, I say that as important as it is for us to help you train your military and your police forces, the only way that you are going to have a stable government over the long term is if the Afghan people feel that you're looking out for them. And that means making sure that the tradition of corruption in the government is reduced.
The tradition of corruption in government is reduced. But Matthew Rosenberg, in your newspaper and elsewhere, we are reading about billions being flown out of Afghanistan, much of that money that has flowed through corruption one way or another. How big is the problem, Matthew?
It's fairly substantial. I recently talked to one government official who deals with corruption, a U.S. government official, who said that to crack down on the government, we need pretty much indicting every cabinet minister, was how he put it, in Afghanistan. The money goes through a circuitous route. The connections are unclear. It's not like American money comes in and somebody grabs it. But you have an economy here of a $13 billion GDP. NATO alone puts $14 billion a year in here, according to their own estimates. You have U.S. development aid of $5 billion and billions more from Europe and elsewhere. It's an economy that simply can't absorb that kind of money. And it just opens up huge avenues to siphon off here and there, to sign in a business, maybe one of your relatives. It's a bit like walking around New York City with $100 bills hanging out of your pocket.
Greg, in Washington, I mean, the bottom line message, and we're going to look at the details here, but the bottom line message we've begun to hear is it's so corrupt that the Afghan people won't support this government. On the other hand, if, as Matthew says, you went after this corruption, you might take out the entire cabinet. You don't have a government to work with or for, leaving the United States in what looks like an awfully tough spot, Greg.
Yeah, it's a big mess and a real predicament for the administration because they're torn now. Is it better to fix it or to try to fix it, or is it better to minimize it and just pick your battles? Because on the one hand, there is a belief that unless you try to fix this and root out this corruption, you're not going to get the Afghan people to support this government and you're not going to find a U.S. exit from this war. But the more resources they pour into rooting out the corruption, the more attention they call to it, and that makes the government look more corrupt. It's just further evidence and that breeds this sort of hopelessness that this can be contained and controlled. So it's a real predicament for Obama.
And now there's a clock ticking because Obama has said we're going to start taking troops out of Afghanistan. If they start digging up all these corruption skeletons, very alive, I guess, it's tough to leave.
Yeah, I mean, you face the first attempt to measure progress is coming in just a few months. You have this looming deadline of next July. How much, as he referred to it, the president referred to it as this tradition of corruption in this country, how much can you accomplish in a span of months to turn that around? How much can you really contain it? What's the best way forward?
Matthew Rosenberg in Kabul, put your fork in anywhere. Give us some real-world examples of how some of this corruption works. You've looked at banking. Others have looked at transport and payments for security, much of which people fear goes right back to the Taliban. Put your fork in somewhere. Tell us stories, Matthew, of how it works and what's the scale.
I mean, look, there's a great example down right now where the Taliban is making a big, the U.S. and its allies are making a big push against the Taliban in the Taliban's birthplace, a district just outside Kandahar called Zarray. In the far east of the district, it is totally safe. It is a great place to operate. It's controlled by this minor warlord. He's got roadblocks up in the road. He's got his own private police force. This guy is running the place. He's collecting taxes, and he works. The Americans love him because he keeps order there. But how much of that can you tolerate? You know, can you have a whole country of little warlords who maintain order, collect taxes when people provide minimal services? Is that really what you want? So you've got that in the small cases. You've got, one provincial governor I was interviewing defended himself by saying, look behind you, and behind me there was a safe about waist high. He said, the only money I have is in this safe. I don't know what's in there, $500,000, $1 million, that's everything. When that's your defense against corruption, it seems that, the bar is pretty low in terms of, and I think for the ordinary Afghans, you saw it last week and the week before when this large bank, Kabul Bank, kind of teetered after its management got replaced because they were giving loans to each other, to senior government officials. You go there and you go to the bank and you talk to the depositors, and every other depositor would tell you, the government can't do anything for us. They're all just giving money to each other, and this is our money. There's real anger there.
Counterinsurgency, Greg Miller, means winning the trust of the people. But the people are seeing this, whether it's so-called warlord taxes, which sounds, kind of like can feel like squeeze money, or top officials borrowing money, putting into projects without any backup, sort of driving a bank to the brink by digging in so deep, and then the villas of Afghan top people, you know, lining up in Dubai. Can you have a successful counterinsurgency when you've got that kind of corruption?
That's the big question. You're right. I mean, the emphasis on this as an issue, in part, traces back to the Obama administration's embrace of this counterinsurgency as opposed to a counterterrorism strategy. And the counterinsurgency strategy relies a lot more on building the trust, building up goodwill among the Afghans toward their government. And so this corruption issue poses this dilemma because if it's corrupt and if it's perceived as corrupt, they're not going to rally behind the government. And some senior military officials believe that corruption drives Afghans into the arms of the Taliban in certain districts. But if you go after it, then you risk making it worse because you're calling so much attention to it. And Matthew gave some great examples there that the corruption cuts across a number of different categories. You have large, massive sums of cash just being carried out of the country, sometimes literally on suitcases through the airport in Kabul.
And is that illicit cash?
There is suspicion that some of that, it's not clear how much of that, could be diverted foreign aid, right? It's undoubtedly some of it is legitimate, but it's not clear how much is legitimate and how much is not.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about corruption in Afghanistan, Corruptistan, it's being called, and the future of the U.S. war effort. Matthew Rosenberg of The Wall Street Journal joins us from Kabul in Afghanistan. And from Washington, Greg Miller of The Washington Post is here, national security correspondent. He's co-author of The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda. Gosh, there's so much we've been reading. I mean, all the way back to the great reporting by Aram Rostan in The Nation, some of it coming out earlier this year, some of it last year, about how money might be getting to the Taliban. Greg Miller, tell us about that. I mean, the efforts to just move supplies around the country, get trucks to move on these very dangerous roads, is apparently opened up. I mean, the U.S. is paying a lot for security for those from private contractors, and a very strong suspicion that a bunch of that money ends up with the Taliban, Greg.
That's right. This is an illustration of the sort of classic bind you end up with. There was a very strong and damning congressional report that came out several months ago about this phenomenon, where the U.S. military is spending large sums of money on security to move its supplies from one place to another. The money that it's paying is going to Afghans who in many cases are aligned or linked to the Taliban or the insurgency in some way. So this is sort of sometimes this money, and much of it looks like protection money that's going to the bad guys.
Matthew Rosenberg, in Afghanistan, it doesn't all end up in Afghan hands either. I mean, it would appear that we've got foreign contractors, American contractors in on some of this. Is that corruption? Is that just business? Is the line clear, Matthew?
I don't think the line's clear at all. One of the problems here is how do you price what you're doing in a war zone, remote war zones? I know a few people who are involved in, say, the construction business, and they help build bases for the Marines and the Army. But these guys have grown incredibly wealthy on this. They have their own villas in Dubai. These are Americans. They have apartments in London. Now, what percentage are they taking off these contracts, and how are they pricing their goods? Those are huge questions, and the U.S. military has now stood up some task forces to look at this a little more closely, but that's something they've done in the last few months, and it's certainly not a problem or a question that they have a handle on quite yet.
And that big money continues to go to firms to build, to supply, with a suspicion that, more than a suspicion in some case, that it ends up where it shouldn't end up. You've got top officials involved in that. Greg, look, maybe this is just the price. I mean, war is messy. Is this just the price of doing war? Is this different, what's going on in Afghanistan, from the kind of payments to, the Sunni awakening people in Iraq that we saw?
Well, that's a good question, actually, Tom. I mean, I've actually spoken with senior Obama administration officials in the past couple of weeks who will say, you know, the corruption problem in Afghanistan is no worse than it was in Iraq. It just never surfaced as such an issue in Iraq. It never was allowed to surface in that way. And so that's why some in the administration believe this is becoming sort of a self-inflicted wound, and in calling so much attention to it and challenging Karzai so stridently in some cases, they're making the problem worse.
Matthew, how does drug money come in here? There's a lot of reporting on opium flowing out of Afghanistan, very big poppy crops there. How does that figure into the corruption scene, and where does that drug money land in the power structure in Afghanistan?
I mean, it's certainly a big piece of it. You have varying estimates of how much it's worth and how much gets painted Afghan hands, but it's certainly hundreds of millions or billions. A number of very senior officials have been allegations of drug smuggling. Proving this stuff has been incredibly difficult. I think anywhere in the world, these are complicated investigations, made more complicated, but in fact, this is a very underdeveloped war zone. But some of that cash flowing out of the airport, too, is presumed to be the profits from the opium trade.
Cash out of the airport, and what about ties to people in the government? What about ties to American efforts there? There's been talk of CIA money going to some of the same people, Greg, that are being under significant suspicion for corruption.
Right. There's a sense now that that the U.S. is trying to change the rules of this game 9 years into the war, because the agency, the CIA, arrived in Afghanistan within weeks carrying suitcases full of cash to pay off warlords, to win their loyalty in the effort to oust the Taliban. And Afghans that were backed by the agency used that backing in many cases to maneuver into important government positions after the Taliban was pushed out. And so now you're sort of have, in some cases, efforts, U.S.-backed efforts to investigate and go after corruption that is being driven in some cases by Afghans who may in many cases still be on the CIA payroll. I've had senior officials say that a significant number of Karzai's inner circle is on the CIA payroll. Many warlords, many important and influential Afghans in districts around the country are paid by the CIA.
Matthew, we heard the president himself saying in his press conference last week, referring to a tradition of corruption in the Afghan government. What does that tell us? On the one hand, he's talking about a tradition. On the other hand, the kind of billions Afghanistan has seen, you know, gushing in are hardly traditional. And we're hearing that the Afghan people themselves aren't happy with this corruption. Is this just tradition? And if it's just tradition, why are people so upset about it?
Well, I think he's partly right and partly wrong there. This is an underdeveloped society. Patronage networks, family, these kind of things matter. So what often looks corrupt to us in latter-day America would be a lot like machine politics back in the day in Chicago or New York. But the thing is these old patronage networks used to operate with very little resources. We have now just poured money into a place that is totally ill-equipped to handle it. And in some ways, you know, enabled this kind of corruption. We said, okay, we've got this patronage network that used to handle $100 a month. It probably now handles $300 million. Maybe that's an exaggeration. But we put so much money in here, and we've done a very bad job of overseeing it. And like Greg said, you know, the CIA walked in here with suitcases of cash. That provincial governor I referred to earlier who said he had $1 million in his safe,
yes,
he was CIA favorite in 2001, and he's still on the payroll by all accounts. This is a guy who worked very closely with the agency.
So is that corruption, or is that just counterinsurgency?
That's a good question.
Good question.
It's a very good question. You know, there are officials here who do put something back. They steal, but they put something back, and they're popular for it.
At the same time, we're seeing efforts to stop this. The FBI's been in there working, Greg. NATO has a big interest in seeing this cleaned up, but the President Karzai has been pushing back very specifically against that.
The DEA as well has been heavily involved, and it's interesting because it's, you know, we've talked about how this affects the coin strategy, the counterinsurgency strategy, but in a more direct way, it really leads to these ruptures in the relationship between Washington and Kabul. What's happened over the past 2 years is the U.S. through the DEA and FBI and others have helped create and advise these entities, they're Afghan entities that are starting to investigate this. One of the important things the U.S. also did was bring in significant technology, including a very large wiretapping system that can suck up cell phone calls around the country. So we're now seeing cases that have come out of through the pipelines of those investigations, and that helps to explain why this issue has surfaced over this past year in such a significant way. But in each of these cases, in many of these cases, they run into immediate interference from the palace. They start work on an investigation of this minister or that official. They start to gather evidence. They go to the attorney general, and quickly something is shut down. The investigators are instructed to take the name, a certain name, out of a case file, or to put a file in the file cabinet and not pull it back out altogether. There's been a lot of friction, and it's not resolved yet between the government here in Washington and the government in Kabul over how to proceed with these cases.
Matthew, we read the reporting from Kabul that the Afghan corruption inquiries have actually been kind of frozen or shut down by the government there, including the U.S. and NATO-backed efforts, Matthew.
President Karzai has moved pretty swiftly in the last 6-7 weeks to limit the independence of a number of these kind of signature initiatives, signature kind of task force or units that were built and advised by the Americans. A lot of this stems from the arrest of one of his close aides on allegations of taking a bribe. He was arrested in July. And since then, President Karzai has moved to kind of stop all this. I mean, look, a lot of that kind of assumed that there were a lot of arrests beforehand. There weren't. This has kind of been building. But the pushback in the last 2 weeks from the Afghan side has been pretty strong. And I think that's partly why you're seeing a debate the reason you're seeing a debate in Washington right now. Maybe we should downplay this. Maybe we shouldn't go so aggressively after corruption because of the pushback to this arrest in July.
But if the corruption is creating disillusionment on the ground that pushes Afghans into the arms of the Taliban, it seemed like you've got a structural problem. Let's go to our listeners. They've been following along here. Glen Falls, New York. Marshall, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going today?
Okay, what do you think, Marshall?
Well, first of all, I'd like to just get back to a comment I heard about how the administration seemed to think that shooting itself in the foot by exposing so much corruption as opposed to Iraq. A lot of people, I think, already knew the corruption was going on in Iraq. It was simply kept out of the major media. So that right there, I think, is very revealing. But you know, basically, I think the Taliban are offering an ideological sort of a center, and the U.S. just basically comes in waving money. So, I mean, who do you think you're going to be getting on your side? I mean, it just seems, you know, kind of a no-brainer. And also, I think most of it just seems to be revolving around that we've got to get out of there. It was an ill-conceived war from the start, and basically, I think most people just see it as eventually just someone's going to arbitrarily declare victory and we're all going to go home. And the idea is to leave something that won't explode immediately, you know, like the South Vietnamese government, so that we can get out with a little bit of grace anyway.
Leave the billions, leave the blood, and go. Thank you, Marshall. One more here from Des Moines, Iowa. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I heard a comparison a few minutes ago about comparing the corruption in Iraq with corruption in Afghanistan. I think the big difference, though, is between the leaders. Karzai is no Maliki. And I think you could say, I've read articles basically saying that Karzai is a pretty heavy drug user himself and sometimes completely incoherent. So I think...
I don't know about that, but okay.
We need to stick with the timeline that was outlined by President Obama. And then if they can't get the corruption situation under control, then, I don't think it's worth sticking around for losing American lives and money. And what I was referring to the drug use, too, was with opiates, that he used significant amounts of opiates, but I'm not sure.
I really do not know about that piece, but I do know the suspicion around the government, more than suspicion, you know, very cabinet members and family members and right on, very high, very firm. Mike, thank you for your call. Greg Miller, our first two calls, and you hear how this goes down in this country, not very well. I mean, there's already real problems with levels of support for this war effort, and now you've got corruption that looks bad to people. There's yet another piece of it. Afghans don't like it. Americans don't like it, and it could figure in big on how much support remains for the effort.
That's true, and this is another very sensitive area for the administration. They're very sensitive to this. They know that support for this war has been eroding, declining, and if this government that the United States is backing in Kabul is perceived as hopelessly corrupt, then that the case for continuing is all the harder to make. And there are immediate implications for the administration. Already they are facing an effort in Congress to withhold billions of dollars in aid for Afghanistan unless there are firmer checks in place and clearer evidence that the corruption problem is contained. So, I mean, their funding for huge projects in Afghanistan is already threatened.
Let's go to New Orleans, Louisiana, and Mac. Mac, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how we can say that the corruption in Afghanistan is condemnable when in the United States our politicians line their pockets with our tax dollars, and similarly why we can condemn the warlord that you mentioned earlier who might be taking some taxes, you know, maybe under the threat of violence, but here we threaten imprisonment and violence as well when we collect our taxes. So I'm just curious how we can condemn Afghanistan when we do the same thing here.
Mac, that's interesting. Louisiana knows something of that, but not only Louisiana, of course, in this country. I mean, Matthew Rosenberg, you're there. You know, every country has some corruption. Speak to the scale issues, Afghanistan versus what else we may have seen, Afghanistan versus the United States.
You know, when I talk to Afghan officials, I often make this point. Look, corruption exists everywhere. The difference is how you manage it. You know, maybe the garbage guys pick up your garbage, rig the bid if you live somewhere in the U.S., but the garbage gets picked up. Here, often, if you get your taxes collected, whatnot, you don't get anything for it. You know, you don't get a service. Your roads aren't built. Your phones don't work. Your power goes out all the time. Now, that's not entirely Afghan officials' fault. We have a huge role here, and the U.S. has not delivered either in terms of helping rebuild infrastructure here. But I think there's a sense that the money that's taken, none of it goes back. And the few politicians here who do give things back, who have improved the areas where they rule, even if they are considered corrupt, are often very popular. They're popular national figures.
And Greg Miller, not every country with corruption is in the middle of a war, not a war involving the United States. I mean, I saw a ranking where on the basis of, I guess, corruption, Afghanistan was second to last in the world, ahead only of Somalia, Greg.
Somalia, yes, that's right. Right, which, you know, that's a dismaying ranking to consider, right? This is, we're 9 years into what has essentially been a concentrated U.S. effort in nation building. And 9 years in, what you have is the second most corrupt country on the planet.
There's a new effort unrolled this summer, Task Force 2010, to stamp out corruption, new vigor. Is that still on? Is General Petraeus, you know, can we change, let's say, the contracting, the way the U.S. money, the NATO money moves around the country to reel this back in, Greg, or is it just out of hand?
Yes, as Matthew indicated, the military in particular, the U.S. military in particular, has created a number of mechanisms now where it is trying to take more control over the amount of money it is doling out there through contracts and security contracts and things like that. But the military is also sending other signals that we're sort of picking up on here in Washington, because there is this disagreement within the government, and it's surfacing from time to time that different parts of the U.S. government believe the corruption problem should be treated in different ways. So on one extreme, you have FBI very serious about it. The military is more worried about, we should just focus on the corruption that drives people to the Taliban and not worry so much about everything else.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about corruption in Afghanistan. Corruptistan, it's being called, and the future of the U.S. war effort there. General David Petraeus, large and in charge in Afghanistan to the extent anyone can be, top U.S. commander there, talked with NPR this week, and he said a lot of progress has been made in addressing corruption. Let's listen.
In the judicial sector alone, there have been hundreds of judicial employees who have been fired, some sent to jail, dozens of judges among those, by the way. A number of high-ranking police officials, including the former commander of the Western Border Police in Afghanistan, put in jail. Police chief in a major province put in jail, governors fired, and a number of other activities. The Minister of Finance has just recently fired dozens of customs officials, for example. But again, President Karzai is the first to note that more has to be done.
President Karzai first to note that some more has to be done, and yet he's intervening very directly to put the brakes on some of these inquiries. Matthew Rosenberg of the Wall Street Journal is with us from Kabul. Greg Miller with the Washington Post is here. Joining us right now from Washington is Anthony Cordesman. He's at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, been an advisor to top players in Afghanistan. His new report on the corruption problem is titled How America Corrupted Afghanistan, Time to Look in the Mirror. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Anthony Cordesman, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Is this something that the United States can work around, work through? Can we fix it? Is it indeed creating an insurmountable problem for the war goals, the war aims?
I think we need to be very careful about Afghan sensitivities here. Certainly, Afghans find this to be a day-to-day problem. But much of the problem they face is what actually happens in the street. It is not anything to do with the central government. It is, if there is a police presence, the police have often been underpaid, basically have not had the leadership or the training. So when an Afghan talks about corruption, they're talking about corruption that may make it difficult to move within the area they're living in. They may see people come and simply steal things because the police have not been properly paid or trained, and sometimes the Afghan forces. They may see a district head or a district chief that is a key figure, but in polls that came out about a week ago, corruption was not one of the highest priorities. Security was by far the key. Living standards was another, and then the expectations that things would be better under the government. So that was things like power and health services and education were the dominating concerns. And if you look at what actually we have by way of maps of where there's effective governance, which is one measure of corruption, if the government isn't there at all, it isn't having a corrupt impact. The key problem is government services and prompt justice. It's not corruption per se. The other factor here to remember is we've been at this now for 9 years, as was pointed out earlier. I can remember this being raised in the field as a serious problem that we had no contract supervision or control, that basically people weren't using proper accounting procedures or controlling the flow of the money back in 2003, and groups like the Government Accountability Office have raised this every year since that time. There's a special inspector general for Afghan reconstruction, and in their most recent report, there is a long description of the fact we actually have a draft interagency agreement on an anti-corruption strategy which has a range of measures far beyond anti-corruption drive. That still has not been approved, but that includes measures which really are far more important than anti-corruption drive. They basically call for the U.S. and its allies and the U.N. for the first time to start looking at where the money goes, to worry about which ministries and which provinces and districts have competent Afghan officials. And if you work out in the field, you see a lot of very courageous and competent Afghans, not simply people who are on the take. It calls for actual auditing of how U.S. and foreign contractors deal with this money. It calls for basically using electronic fund transfers and other basic accountability tools, and there's a whole list of these.
So you're focused on what ordinary Afghans are seeing, the police, underpaid policeman who asks for money at the roadside, and that puts the government in competition with the Taliban, I guess.
Well, it doesn't put the government with it in competition. Unfortunately, you can have, and I've watched this, the police run a checkpoint, and then you can see overhead of the Taliban running a checkpoint 3 kilometers away. The Taliban is not as corrupt as some of the people in the field have been. It's interesting to note that many of the police, until really last year, were paid far less than the Taliban, and less than a living wage when they got the money. But these are problems that the ordinary Afghans see.
I was reading Dexter Filkin's piece in the New York Times, what was it, a week ago now. I mean, he's talking about awareness of Afghans of problems at the top. He quoted a currency exchange guy in Kabul, Ahmed Shah Hakimi, who says, you know, everybody knows that there are these top Americans. There are 50 of them, the corrupt ones. He said all the Afghans know who they are. He said the Americans need to take these Afghans, put them on a plane and fly them to America or crash it into a mountain. I mean, that the suggestion there is that people do know that there's big corruption at the top, and it sours them, Mr.
First,
Kirchner.
I've heard people say this for years, and people in Kabul will say that. You do need to remember that Kabul is often the focus of our attention and reporting. It isn't the focus of counterinsurgency, and this is a country in which governance is not only extremely limited, but we did a great deal early on to make sure that it couldn't be effective. For about a year and a half, the U.S. neglected to worry about paying the Afghan civil service. Strangely enough, career people disappeared in the process. But when we're talking about what we're seeing here, I think the key is we're watching flows of money which don't go through Karzai or his family. They go to a whole host of power brokers. Some of them are the people who basically are profiteering within the Afghan forces. One of the reporters mentioned that earlier. But most of this money is either moving out into the field through ministries, through provincial governors, through districts, or through aid organizations, or through people paying for military contract services, which have had by far the largest share of the money, not the aid people. And this is the problem. It is not an elite at the top. It's something that every Afghan sees everywhere. Now, do people have lists of contractors that are corrupt? We were told by UNAMA that they had such a list last year. They refused to share it. And this is the organization in charge of coordinating international aid. And before we blame the Afghans, it has never yet issued a report on how the aid money is being spent. And there's never been an audit or meaningful control over a single UN agency operating in Afghanistan.
Anthony Cordesman, we heard President Obama himself talking there in his press conference about a, quoting him, tradition of corruption in Afghan government. But the title of your report is How America Corrupted Afghanistan. What do you mean by that?
Well, I've been in Afghanistan off and on since the early 70s, although nobody was there during the Russian occupation. Like most countries in the developing world, it has a very large black economy. The official government structure has always been one of power brokers. The warlords are relatively recent, if you cite 1979 onwards development, but the fact is this is how the Afghan government has always operated. Now, we put a constitution in place which gave the president and the central ministries virtually all of the money that goes through the government. But if you look at how the money has actually been spent, most of the aid money doesn't go through the central government. And when it comes down to military spending in the field, which has just been leaping up over the course of the last 2 years, that money is directly spent. But the problem is there haven't been good controls dealing with it. So what you've seen in a society where no one has any security, where the structure of government has in many ways been imposed from the outside and concentrated in one place, and most of the Afghan officials in the field face either the problem of jeopardizing their lives if they're dealing with the Taliban or constant struggles with power brokers, that money has simply flowed in every direction and created an incredible amount of money where neither the United States, the United Nations, or any of our allies have maintained minimally effective controls over the money. And all of this is very well documented in reporting by the Special Inspector General and to a lesser extent by the Government Accountability Office.
Anthony Cordesman, so bottom line, can we stop it? Can we tamp it down significantly? Can NATO, the U.S., live with this corruption and succeed, or does it undermine the very effort we're 9 years into now?
Well, we're 9 years into a war, and we've resourced it for the last two. And over the course of about the last 14 months, what you have begun to see, and these are absolutely critical measures, you change the flow of the money. You are now basically in direct funding, giving it only to the ministries that have shown they use the money effectively. You are basically choosing the provincial governors. If they're effective, they get the money and indeed an incentive for being honest, and that money is a key source of power to them. If they're not, you go to the assembly or the body under them. If that doesn't work, the money goes down to the districts. And if the district can't be functional, the money now goes directly out to assemblies of tribal leaders. These basically bypass the kind of rampant corruption that we've been primarily responsible for. The tools in place are just beginning to be in place because, again, the actual surge that everybody talks about, you're just getting the troop levels fully in place this month. You haven't had a surge of civilians yet. And as those people come in, the problem is you have to restructure not simply corruption and contracting. You have to try to create effective measures and programs in the field that are integrated civil-military programs for the first time. And in area after area, people simply don't understand how long it has taken to get a meaningful counterinsurgency presence of any kind in at the provincial, district, or local level.
Tough, tough picture. Anthony Cordesman, his big new report is How America Corrupted Afghanistan. You can link to it at our website. Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mark in Sumter, South Carolina. Mark, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, here in the States, we've heard about corruption in Afghanistan for years. And I would like to know if the panel, well, on a side note, talking about following the money, it kind of harkens back to that palletized $10 million in Iraq that just disappeared. And I was wondering if your panel could discuss how maybe us propping up the Kabul Bank, which has been in the news lately, mm-hmm. but only under the radar, sort of, how that might perpetuate corruption in Afghanistan.
Greg Miller, we all saw the headlines, Afghans banging on the doors of the bank, no confidence in it. There was a run on the bank. And everybody worried about that going down. Corruption, as Matthew Rosenberg was saying, behind it. What does it tell us?
Well, this was another sort of example where the U.S. helped to create that institution to solve problems in that country. That bank was seen as a way to introduce sort of modern banking to that country. And in fact, many Afghan government employees get their money dispersed through payments that are deposited in that bank now. But at the same time, you had just it only surfaced this year, really, how badly run this bank was, where you had shareholders, senior officials, relatives of Karzai who were making loans to themselves, essentially, with no terms for payback and the money being used to buy villas in Dubai and other extravagances like that.
Matthew Rosenberg, you're there. Anthony Cordesman says, look, we haven't paid enough attention, but we can. His suggestion is this can be turned around. Does that sound reasonable to you, and can it be turned around on a timetable that works for the United States, works for Afghanistan?
I mean, anything can be turned around. You're right. What's the timetable? I think one of the challenges the U.S. has, especially the military, is the capacity to get out and find out where its money is being spent. You know, the average kind of soldier or officer who's looking into this stuff can't just hit the streets of Kabul and walk around and see what's happening. So I know I was talking to one of the person who runs this new Task Force 2010, which is supposed to look at where they're spending their money, and she said, you know, we've put in clauses about, you know, theft of goods from deliveries that are being made to bases to try and stop that, and we've put in all this new language in the contract to try and firm things up. And that's all fine and good, but you take half a mile away in the streets of Kabul and people are selling stuff right off that clearly came off the back of supply trucks, you know, hard plastic cases the military uses to carry things. And so I think there is that problem where how can you get out and do the due diligence on the people you're working with to make sure your money's being spent right? And I think people mean well right now, but they still don't necessarily have what they need to get out and look at what they're doing.
Mean well, but can't necessarily, don't have the security maybe to be out on the street to find out what's actually going on. Greg, what do you think? More crackdown, or is the U.S. going to try and back off of this and muddle through here?
I think they're going to try to find a different balance here, where perhaps they try to deal with this more privately in negotiations with Karzai that don't embarrass him as much. And probably the military will push for a greater focus on the sort of local corruption that Anthony Cordesman was talking about, and less vigorous pursuit of top government officials in Kabul.
Meanwhile, the villas go up in Dubai. Greg Miller with The Washington Post, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Matthew Rosenberg with The Wall Street Journal in Kabul, thank you so much for being there, Matthew. We really appreciate your time. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.